This is Linda Leonard, April 6th, 1990. Creativity and the Veil of Addiction.
Without any further ado, I would like to present tonight's speaker to you. Her name is Linda Leonard. Many of you have probably read her books. Her first two books that were out were Wounded Woman and On the Way to the Wedding, and she's just recently finished another book, which we have for sale out front, called Witness to the Fire. It's on creativity and addiction. And she'll be giving a workshop tomorrow over at Cornish, and you can register for that tonight if you'd like. I know some people have already, but you can do that here as well as tomorrow at the door. Without any further ado, I'd like to present to you Linda Leonard.
Well, just before I start, I just usually like to get a little sense of who's in the audience. So I wondered how many people here are involved in some kind of artistic creative activity? Okay. And how many people here are familiar with the 12 Steps program? That's a lot. And how many are familiar with Jung? That's just about everybody. Okay. And how many, well, no, I won't ask that. So what I think that's enough. So what I thought I would, I guess I would like to know, did anybody come to the lecture I gave last year? Because this will be pretty much the same lecture, so it'll be a little bit different because I do it kind of spontaneously, but it will be similar to the last one. So just be prepared. maybe it'll have other stuff too. What I usually like to do is tell you how I came to write my book and to be involved with this topic, because so far in my writing process, each of the books that I've written has come out of a personal need of mine to transform. And the writing process itself has helped me in that process of transformation. And so my background in terms of the theme of addiction is a pretty strong one. Just about every man in my family has been an alcoholic. I have one half uncle who isn't, but all of the rest, and maybe a half cousin or so who isn't, but all the rest have been alcoholics and died of it. And my two grandfathers were immigrants from Europe, and one was. A very kind of Dionysian man, but he was noted to be a kind of dark personality and a little bit of a brutal side. And the story is there that he was kind of in the midst of a drunken debauch and somehow the stove got turned over and he got killed somewhere in the process of fire. That's my father's father. My father is also an alcoholic, or was, I should say. I guess he is somewhere else. But anyway, and then my mother's father was also an alcoholic, and he was kind of a happy-go-lucky kind of man, and he ran a drinking and dancing club during the Prohibition and smuggled booze in, and they put that booze under my mother's mattress when she was a little girl. My mother's not an alcoholic. And she grew up, however, in this great, and she loved her father, regardless of his drinking. And she grew up around this atmosphere of drinking and dancing and the lure of the forbidden. And that's where she met my father, because he and all his brothers came to this club to drink and dance during the Prohibition. So that when I grew up, there were kind of two atmospheres around drinking. There was kind of the horror of it, because particularly seeing my father go downhill, he particularly started going downhill when I was around 9 or so. But there was also a kind of a romantic allure and an excitement to it. And the way I dealt with it personally was initially was not to drink at all. hardly ever. My grandmother was a teetotaler, and she emphasized that aspect. I was very cautious around alcohol, and so I compensated. My personality is quite a bit like my father's, but I compensated by studying, and I put a lot of my energy into that. And I was just very cautious around alcohol, so I really very rarely drank, even up through my 20s. But when I was 30, I fell in love with an artist who drank, and there was a certain night where it was very romantic, and there was candlelight and on the table, and he offered me a glass of red wine, and I thought of the movie Days of Wine and Roses, which, do you remember that movie? That's where, for those of you who don't, but you probably have all seen it, where the woman came from an alcoholic family, so she didn't drink, and then she met this man who drank, and she took the drink, and then she went downhill very fast as an alcoholic and died from it. I thought of that movie, but I took that drink. And although it's not that I hadn't ever had drinks before that, I had, but I always had a lot of caution around it, I guess. And but something different happened that night, I think. And that coincided with my moving to Zurich to study at the Jung Institute, actually. And so I entered upon a European lifestyle in which usually there's drinking with lunch and with dinner. And I got into the habit of writing and drinking. And I was a writer initially. I studied journalism, and I was a newspaper reporter in my early 20s, and on a small town paper. And at that time, I didn't drink, so it wasn't an issue for me then. But at this point, I started drinking and writing. So I lived in Europe, and I had a wonderful romantic but also depressive time there. And in the meantime, though, a disease process was taking place in me. And so at a certain point, the alcoholism disease was taking over. And I began to realize, I guess somewhere in my late 30s, you know, that I had a drinking problem. And at about that time, my father died. And maybe I should just add, for the sake of drama, because people were into addiction like drama, that before that, my father had fallen asleep while drinking and smoking, and he had repeated that death by fire. Not his death, but my grandmother's death. She got the house caught on fire, and she got trapped upstairs. That happened, and then very shortly after that, my father died from alcoholism. My mother always would step in and rescue him. That's why. Otherwise, he would have been, you know, on Skid Row, I suppose. So when he died, at that point, I realized that I needed to write a book about the father-daughter relationship, because that was interfering with my relationship with men. But I also knew at that point that I had a drinking problem. And my hope was that if I could work out the dynamics, the psychodynamics behind the father-daughter problem, I could be a normal social drinker. That was my hope. So I wrote the book, and I would write. And, you know, in a cafe, I usually write in a cafe for 3 hours and have one or two glasses of wine as in that process. And then I would stop writing and the drinking would continue. So by the time I finished the book, and it took me a lot longer to finish that book than any other at this rate, I realized that I was not going to be a normal drinker. So I did, however, feel that I transformed a lot with the father-daughter relationship and the relationship with men. And one of the great gifts that was given to me was really to feel compassion for my father, who I'd loved as a small child, grown to hate and felt estranged from. And then being like him, of course, that really contributed to a lot of low self-esteem in myself. So it helped me really reconcile with my father and and with men in a certain way, but it didn't help me deal with the drinking. So at that point, I felt that I could only write if I drank, and I stopped writing. But also, I was angry that I couldn't drink. And I think that, and I didn't really write for 3 years, and I tried, during those 3 years, I tried to stop drinking on my own, and I tried various methods of control, and they would work for a while, but then I would have a relapse, and essentially I was in people call dry drunks. That is, I would be dry, but my attitudes were like those of an addict or an alcoholic. And I now see with this book, I have a figure in here called the Underground Man, who comes from Dostoevsky, who was an addict, not an alcoholic, but he was a gambler. And so many of Dostoevsky's characters come out of his experience with addiction, and he has one called the Underground Man. How many people have read Notes from Underground? So that's quite a few. So those of you who have read that know that the Underground Man was once a romantic, a dreamer, and he had great hopes for life, but he found that life reality wasn't like what he wanted and what he could get, and so he decided to leave it and live his own in his own kind of rebellious manner underground, so to speak, in the basement of his own house. And basically, the novel is just an incredible study of resentment and of a person caught up in brooding and bitterness. At a certain point, he reaches out for love but could have it, but then he rejects it. So I think that character was very, very much in my life during this period. And so then, basically, as that disease process progressed in myself, things became worse and worse until finally I had a series of serious relapses, and I had to go. Basically, I couldn't stop drinking on my own. I'd be not drink for a long time. I'd take a drink and then be pretty much in a blackout for 10 days, 2 weeks, with occasional moments where I could call up for some vodka or something. And I don't like vodka. That's what I was doing. And so I had to go and to a detox center and have people, you know, where I couldn't get anything to drink. At that point, I was really in great despair and humiliation and in terror and in horror at where I was. And because on the one hand, here I, you know, had all of this training, not only intellectually and as an analyst, but I couldn't deal with this at all. And so at that point, I then finally reached out for help and went to AA. Now, as you know, at the level of press, radio, and television, membership in AA is anonymous. And so if there's anybody here doing anything with that, I just ask you to honor that tradition. I tried to, in the book, what I tried to do was give my personal experience, but not say I was a member of AA, but that's what helped me. And so, at that point, but I was also a Jungian analyst and also somebody who has been involved my whole life with art and literature, and I love art and literature and the whole creative process. And so for myself, in addition to working with the 12 steps, which I'll talk about later, because I see them as paralleling the creative process, I had to try to understand what the relationship was between creativity and between addiction. And since literature is my bent, I turned to writers who I knew were addicts of one kind or another to see if they had drawn portraits of inner figures that were that could turn to addiction or that could give some insight into creativity, too. Can everybody follow me? So I turned especially to Dostoevsky because he was a gambler, and also he wrote out incredible psychological portraits of many, many figures. But I also turned to Jack London, who was an alcoholic and had written a portrait of himself as an alcoholic called John Barleycorn Confessions of, I think it's called An Alcoholic Memoir, Confessions of an Alcoholic or something like that, describing his own experience with alcohol as a trickster. And then I turned to Jean Rhys, who is a British writer, who basically was, I would say, addicted to romance, and who tried to write out through her novels what her obsession with romance was. And she later, I think, became an episodic alcoholic. And she lived incredibly long despite that. I turned to Eugene O'Neill, and also I got insights from lots of different people. I was really very much influenced by the film director, Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Do you know him? Who was an addict of, all kinds, just about, and died of a cocaine overdose when he was 38. He'd already done about 20 films, I think, and, I mean, some remarkably superb films. And so his films, though I was going to do a lot with his work on, with his long epic Berlin-Alexanderplatz, finally never got into the book. But so a lot of different, actually, writers and artists who were addicted in one way or another are in this book, though they may or may not be mentioned. So what I did was I tried to draw out portraits, archetypal energetic portraits of what goes on in the psyche of a person who is addicted, and it could be to anything, because although personally I started out with alcohol, I realized that addiction was much broader than that, and then how those energies could be turned into the creative, and I then paralleled the 12 steps with the creative process. And I also interviewed a lot of recovering people and put some of their stories in the book. So that's pretty much what I did. And I think in the, do you usually, at a certain point, do you usually take a break here? Yeah, well, I thought what I'd do in the first half is give a kind of a general, you know, view, and then in the second half maybe go into some of those figures, and then we can have questions and answers or whatever you want to do. So after I started the 12-step program, something happened to me, and I guess I was given a gift of hope, essentially. And my underground man, for a moment, stepped back, and I was released from my bitterness because I was so grateful that something was helping me not to drink. And that enabled me to open up to the creative forces inside myself that were kind of dark, in the dark night of the soul. That's where I really was. And I was able to start writing again. And I wrote, at that point, I wrote On the Way to the Wedding. On the Way to the Wedding is a book that has a lot of different levels to it. It's a book about the search for the soulmate. It's also a book about the inner wedding. And for me, it was also a book about my own new wedding with the transcendence via recovery. And it has a chapter or two that's directly related, particularly the demon lover chapter and a chapter called the ghostly lover, which relates to romance. When I was working on that book at a certain point, so this book was gelling all the time somewhere, though I wasn't working on it directly, but I looked up the word addiction in the dictionary, the etymology of the word addiction. And I found that it meant to deliver yourself over to something, often as a slave to a master, to devote yourself to something. It also had the connotation of in Roman times, of being a debtor in service to a creditor. And I had, for some time, had an image called the moneylender, which had popped up in my own dreams and in the dreams of a client who'd been addicted to speed. And I thought I would do something with that image. And then this definition of being a debtor in service to a creditor made me really see that right within the etymology of the word addiction, the moneylender archetype was connected. Well, when I looked in the dictionary, it also suggested that the word hadn't always been used in a negative sense, because it had sometimes meant to to deliver yourself over to the spirits. And then I came across, actually I met at a conference, a man who wrote a book called Christ's. Right now his name is I don't have a present in my mind, but it's referred to in my book. And he did a very extensive etymology there of the word addiction. And apparently, originally, it really had a great focus on the sense of devotion to the spiritual life. And so I thought, well, right within this very word is a kind of attention and the sense of a direction of what do you deliver yourself over to. I felt, in terms of, as an addict, in terms of the alcoholism, that my life had become possessed by the alcohol. And it had become really reduced. Gradually, it became reduced so that other facets of my life became less and less important, and this became the overwhelming thing. And I experienced that as really being a hostage to this. And while I was going through a lot of this, I had a number of clients who came in with dreams of vampires and Dracula. And these dreams then suddenly, I began to relate them to myself, and I realized that in my own addiction, what had happened was really like a vampire phenomena. It was as though I'd given myself over to a vampire like Dracula, let him give me the love bite, so to speak, and was drained out of my life's blood. And as you know, in the Dracula story, the people who were bitten by Dracula do always turn their neck up first to Dracula. So there's an acquiescence on the part of the person who's bitten. And secondly, they become vampires like Dracula themselves. So I felt that the demon lover archetype, particularly as expressed by the image of Dracula, was a very sharp depiction of what I experienced as addiction. And I wrote about that in the wedding book, in the chapter Demon Lover. There's an analysis there of the novel Dracula, and I looked at different characters in the novel as different parts of the psyche. So I thought that's one energy you can turn yourself over to, and that energy then goes to addiction or to destruction. And then the other energy, though, I thought, well, you can turn it over to creativity too. And then I remembered that artists, from time immemorial, talk about the creative daimon. That's a Greek word, daimon. It's also a Roman word, daemon. And it means really the indwelling force or spirit that calls you to creativity, so that the artist feels called to a kind of a vocation that they really have to create. Jung talks about the same thing. He talks about the individuation process, really, as that kind of a call. And he says the libido of the psyche is daimonic. So I thought, well, that's the other archetypal energy, perhaps, that can help me understand what's going on here in this relationship between creativity and addiction, that you can put yourself in the service of the demon lover, or you can put yourself in the service of the creative daimon. And sometimes they feel very close and very similar, because there's a state of possession in each one. But the difference, I felt, was that the demon lover finally drains you of everything, so that you lose your energy and you can't really, in the end, you can't give back, whereas the creative daimon finally regenerates you as you become regenerated in the process of recovery. So I thought that's really the main difference, is that the creative daimon has a giving, generous energy to it that the demon lover energy doesn't have. And so I worked with those two different directions. And then I remembered that I had read a long time ago in Love and Will, a book by Rollo May, that he had two chapters on the creative daimon. So I went back to those, and they're really very good chapters. And he talks there a lot about the daimon and three different ways to relate to this energy that's calling you to create. And he says that you can relate to it in one way so that you become more whole and healthy by accepting the energy and relating to it. And he points out that there's a tension involved in the daimon between the divine and the diabolical, and that you have to learn to stand in the tension in order to be creative. You can also let yourself become possessed by it to the extent where you become fanatical and monomaniacal. And he uses Hitler as an example of someone to whom that happened. And he calls that, well, his term for it is disdaimonic relationship, but it's a relationship to the creative energy where it, instead of going to the creative direction and holding the tension, it goes over to the destructive direction. And then he says there's a third way to relate to it, and that is to try to ward it off and suppress it and not have anything to do with it. So that he calls the anti-daimonic. So those are people who are trying to keep everything in control and usually are living the life of the status quo, so they don't have to deal with this, with the tension of this energy. Can everybody connect with those? That these different ways to relate to it helped me a lot, just to kind of recognize when I was doing, because you can do relate in any of the three ways, when I was kind of going in one direction or when I was going in another. So that helped me get a little bit of an understanding of the process of addiction and creativity. And the other thing that really helped me a lot was an image from St. John of the Cross, who, you know, wrote a book and a poem called The Dark Night of the Soul. And in that book, St. John of the Cross presents an image of, and he compares the soul to a burning log. And he says that as the log burns, there's a certain point in the burning process where it becomes black and ugly and kind of abominable, and it starts to smell. And that happens to the soul too. But as the process goes on, eventually the log merges into the fire and becomes part of the divine fire itself. And he says, so it is with the soul. And that would be the same with the creative fire. There can be that merging with the creative fire, but there's this time of darkness where everything looks really horrible. I mean, so that's the hitting bottom, you know, for people who have whatever kind of addiction they have. There's usually before there's a turning point, before there's any kind of recovery, they hit some kind of a bottom, whatever it happens to be, and they feel that sense of darkness. And the dark part of the burning log experience. The other thing that St. John of the Cross says is that this whole experience is a purification, so that the soul becomes increasingly more spiritually refined and can relate to the divine, and that it doesn't happen in a linear fashion, but it occurs over and over again, so that instead of being, so to speak, cured once or just, you know, doing one kind of creative line effort, you go through this process over and over again, but at increasingly deeper and deeper levels. And this corresponded to my experience both with the Jungian process and also with the creative process and also with recovery, because as I was peeling or looking at the things that were behind the alcohol addiction, I then saw other things, particularly codependency, and how that had operated in my family. And I just saw different layers of attitudes in myself. And it seemed that each time I had to go through, it's like the seasons. There was a winter period, you know, where the seed is in the ground and it feels dark, and then all of a sudden, and you don't, nothing seems to be happening, and you wonder if anything is really going anywhere. And then, though, if you wait long enough and if you're patient, spring happens and that bud comes out, but you have to go through that winter period. So St. John was very important for me in terms of giving me that image, because I felt that it helped me hold through the dark times. Then also, I started doing some workshops on the subject, and I like to, in my workshops, I like to dialogue with people and see, you know, see where they're at and so forth. And in one that was done in Malibu, there were really a lot, particularly a lot of people in the arts of various kinds came to that. And one woman who is an artist said, and this was at the very beginning of my writing of the book, she said that she was having a very peculiar experience because she was finding that she was at her highest level of creativity. At the same time, it's like images were rushing through her. At the same time, while before she'd always considered herself to have an eating problem, a slight eating problem, at this time, she found herself constantly going to the refrigerator. And she was really beginning to hate herself for doing this. She was particularly hooked on brownies. So she couldn't understand why was this happening. And, you know, because here she was having all of this creativity on the one hand, and then she was doing this thing that seemed really destructive on the other. And what she came up with was that the so much creativity was really presenting her with a lot of terror and anxiety that she had to deal with in order to let the things pass through her so that she could form them. And that what she was doing with the eating was she was going to the refrigerator to fend off for comfort against the terror of all the creative stuff that was flowing through her. And she, at the end of the workshop, decided that what she would try to do is try to meditate and each day so that maybe she could deal with the terror, because she knew she had to face the terror. If she turned away from it, she would have been in the anti-daimonic relationship, and she would have been turning away from her creativity. So she had to face the terror, but somehow transform, you know, let it pass through to transform herself. So that's what she did. And I think that a lot of people who have a kind of addiction, whatever it happens to be, whether it's alcohol, it could also be romance, which I think is a very common addiction, or power, or shopping, or whatever, a lot of people are afraid that if they give up whatever it is that they're addicted to, that's giving them something and some kind of a high or seeming to be a high, that they'll lose their link to the creativity. So, and they don't want to, and if they're very creative, they know they can't afford to lose their link to the creativity because that's who they are. They have to create. They have that call in them. So it's very scary for them because they're afraid if they give up the addiction, they won't be able to create. And I think that keeps a lot of people in addiction for a long time, that fear. Though eventually, the addiction, as Dracula does, starts to suck up so much energy, and it drains you of so much that you have less time and energy to create, I think. So I think that's a very, very common dilemma that people in this situation find themselves. So these are some of the insights that that helped me. Another one, it was an archetypal phenomena that both Jung and Eric Neumann talk a lot about, called the wounded healer. And Neumann in particular talks about the archetype of the wounded healer in connection with the creative person. He does this in his book, Art and the Creative Unconscious. He points out that that the person who has been wounded and who has accepted their wounds knows what that wound is all about, and it's out of the experience of their wound that they're able to heal. And he felt that the creative person, in a certain sense, was a vessel for the wounds of their time, even, and that the creative person was a wounded healer. And as I was going through the 12-step program myself, I realized that one of the things that makes that work for lots of people, it may not work for everybody, but it really works for an awful lot of people, is that there, what you have there is a community or a room of wounded healers, and all with the same wound, some further along in the healing of their wounds than others, and that in their giving to each other, they heal themselves and they heal each other's wounds. Can you follow that? So you kind of have, and that's where you then get into a very generous circle of giving instead of this this draining thing that happens with addiction. Then I, as I was looking at the way the 12 steps work, and it seems like almost everyone in here is familiar with those steps, but if anybody isn't, I'd be glad to fill you in. I saw them as relating to phases in the creative process. And I've been working a lot just studying, reading lots of biographies of creative people and studying that process. And I felt that the first three steps, which are basically steps about surrendering to the powerlessness over the addiction, and then having faith that something will come from somewhere that you don't, over an area that you don't know very well and over which you don't have control, and turning yourself over to that process, that process is what an artist does. Because, you know, when you're starting a new project, if you're a writer, you have a blank page. If you're an artist, you have a canvas. A filmmaker, I'm not quite sure what you have, but anyway, there's a period where you don't really know what you're going to do. I mean, you might have an idea, but you don't really know what it is, and you have to give yourself over to the unknown and to the chaos of being in the unknown, to a kind of a void period and an emptiness period, and give it some space in order to allow the new thing, whatever it is, to come up. And to help you. And I felt that this is what's involved in recovery in the first three steps, that you give yourself over, really, you surrender your ego, what you know already, and all of that, and you just give yourself over to something else that then takes over. So I see that as happening in recovery and in the creator process. But then, once you've done that, and during the process that you're creating something, there's an incredible amount of work and struggle that goes on, and sifting and sorting that goes on in order to bring whatever that thing is into being. You have to, you know, decide between words and images, and you really have to struggle with, you know, say writing a novel with the characters, and often the characters don't go the way you want them to go. You know, they take on a life of their own. And you just have to struggle with all of that conflict and sift and sort things out. And it's like a battleground. Lots of artists refer to it as a battleground. Dostoevsky did. Many, many do. And I felt that the steps 4 through 9 are what I call work steps or struggle steps or battleground steps. That's sifting and sorting through all of the various difficult energies that led you to succumb and to be under the power of whatever addiction it was that you had. And there's an incredible amount of work that and facing of dark energy in that period of recovery. And the artist also has to face that same kind of difficult thing. And I think maybe that's partly why a lot of artists, why there's such a prevalence of creativity with artists, because they have to go into so much darkness and chaos, and that's hard to be in. And it takes an incredible amount to be in that and to work through all of that. So I felt that phase of the 12 steps paralleled the creative process. And then there's a phase in the creative process, usually, where you need some rest and regeneration. And many people have written about this, but one person who writes very strikingly about it is the mathematician Poincaré, who talks about how he, you know, will be working with a mathematical idea and so forth, and then suddenly he just can't do any more. And often he would then take his rest by going out for a walk And unexpectedly, sometimes, but not always, in that walk, the breakthrough of the new thing that he couldn't quite figure out how it was going to come together would come through. And I felt that that corresponds to the 11th step, which is a step that deals with meditation and trying to get a more conscious relationship to the divine or the higher power or the creative energy or whatever you want to call it. And it's a time of rest and regeneration that is needed in life, in the recovery process and in the creative process. And I think life itself is a creative process, and that the recovery is creating a new life. So it doesn't necessarily have to be expressed in an artistic medium, though it often is. And then the 12th step, in the 12 steps, is a step where you give from the awareness of your own spiritual work and understanding to others. And I think that same thing is always present in the creative process, where you embody your work and you give it to others and you put it out. And I think lots of people in the creative process are blocked at this stage because they are afraid to give it out, or they feel that what they've done isn't perfect enough, or it doesn't maybe fully, it hasn't fully expressed their vision. And I think that's a struggle that every person goes through anytime they create a work, because the vision is always so much greater than what the finitude of a human being can express. So there's a certain sense in which you have to stand there in the tension of the finitude and the vision. And anyway, even if it isn't perfect, though you want it to be a work of art, you know, which has its own unity and integrity, of course, you put it out there also into an imperfect society. And because I think what stops lots of people is they don't want to put it out because they don't like the society that they're in. And that's some of the underground energy, which we'll go into later. So I think this sense of giving and the sense of embodiment is central to both recovery and to the creative process. And it's really what helps to heal. So what I would like to do now is just end up this part with two myths, one of which I think for me symbolizes the addictive syndrome, and another which symbolizes the creative process. The first one is the myth of Icarus. It's a Greek myth. Many of you are very familiar with it, I'm sure. How many are? That's a lot. And the second one is the Firebird legend from Russia. How many people are familiar with that? Good. So I'll just tell them very briefly, and then I think we could take a break and come back, and then I can present some of those figures if you like, or answer questions or whatever. So in the story of Icarus, you probably remember that Icarus' father, Daedalus, was a very creative person. He was an inventor, and he invented the compass and the potter's wheel, I think. And a king was very impressed with his creative abilities and asked him to design a labyrinth. And after Daedalus did this, Daedalus is the father, after Daedalus designed the labyrinth, the king wanted to possess Daedalus's creative powers. And so he put him as hostage into the labyrinth along with his son, Icarus. Now, I think the hostage that's the first chapter in my book, and that's the way I felt when I was at the bottom in my addiction. It's also often the way I felt in the creative process. Okay. Anyway, Daedalus, being a very creative person, tried to find a way out. The labyrinth was on an island. It was surrounded by water. There didn't seem to be any way to get out. When suddenly he saw some bird feathers on the ground, and he got the great idea of was on an island. It was surrounded by water. There didn't seem to be any way to get out. When suddenly he saw some bird feathers on the ground, and he got the great idea of designing and making some pairs of wings. And he thought if he could do that and attach them to himself and to his son Icarus, that they could fly out. So he did that. He collected all these feathers and he threaded them together and attached them to the body with some wax. And they were very great wings. And when they were ready to try to escape, he told Icarus that you have to realize that Daedalus, the father, was used to a lot of creative work, and so he knew that about this tension and that you have to deal with limits in the creative process. And so he knew the limits of the wings and the whole thing that he had created, so that he told Icarus that if he flew too high to the sun, that the wax might melt and that the wings would fall off and he would drown. But if he flew too low, he would be pulled by force of gravity into the ocean. So he suggested to Icarus that he follow him, Daedalus, and that Icarus try to set some kind of a middle course. Now, I think that's something that often happens in both with creativity and with addiction, that there's a tendency to go too high, you know, to inflation, though some of that is required in creativity, and the opposite tendency is to be deflated and not to think you can do anything at all, and then you're pulled down into a depression. Anyway, in the myth, Daedalus took off and Icarus followed him, but Icarus was really thrilled with the power of these wonderful wings, and so he got really excited and he got a high, and he became so intoxicated with the power of the wings that he just flew and he flew and he flew and he flew, and he was feeling really great. But suddenly he was so close to the sun, and the sun's heat melted the wax, and he fell into the ocean. And that's, I think, where addicts find themselves, at the point where they hit bottom in that ocean. And you probably may remember some words of Joseph Campbell. I think he says this in his book, Myths Men Live By. I can't remember whether he said it on that TV stuff or not. But anyway, he points out in this particular book that the schizophrenic, the shaman, the mystic, the artist, and the mythological hero are all in the same waters. And the difference is that the ones who survive learn how to swim in the waters, so that the schizophrenic somehow can't swim in the waters when the schizophrenic is, you know, schizophrenic. And then I feel that I would add the addict, that the addict is in those waters too and will drown, but if he can learn how to swim in the waters, then he can recover. And that's the same kind of knowledge that the artist has, that the shaman has, that the mist and the mystic has, and the mythological hero. So that's the story of Daedalus and Icarus. Now, the firebird story is a little different. There are a lot of different fairy tales of the firebird, and many of you probably know Stravinsky did a ballet based on one of those fairy tales. There's a basic legend of the firebird from which these differentiated tales come. And if you want to find that, you can find it in a book called Land of the Firebird, written by Suzanne Massey. It's a book, a very beautiful book about the cultural history of Russia. In that book, she tells this legend. And in the legend, there's an orphan girl named Mariushka. And Mariushka has this gift of being able to embroider upon cloth and take thread and jewels and out of all of this make wonderful, wonderful pieces of cloth and garments. And so she has this incredible gift, and she makes these beautiful things, and she sells them for a modest price. She's an orphan and wants to stay in the little town where she's born because she feels that that's her connection with her parents. They're buried there, and the people in the community. Well, pretty soon, the things that she makes are so beautiful that word of her gets around, and merchants find out about her, and they want to buy up her products. But she wants her what she makes to be able to go to everybody, and so she won't work for any one merchant. So the merchants go back, disappointed, but nevertheless they go back. But eventually, word of her creativity spreads far across the land, to a far distant point in the land where an evil sorcerer named Koshai lives. And Koshai is kind of a demon lover figure. He has, or he thinks he has in his possession, all the most beautiful things in the world. And he wants to own all beauty and all creativity. So when he hears that out there is this very creative person making these beautiful things that he doesn't have in his power, in his possession, he gets very angry. And he decides to add it to his collection. So he passes over impossible oceans, forests, mountains, as people do in legends and fairy tales, and arrives at Mariushka's door and changes his form to a handsome young lad. And he knocks on the door and tells her that he's heard, you know, about her talents and asks to see what she has. And she shows him and says that if there's not something there that he likes, she'd be happy to try to, you know, create something else. Well, when he looks at all of this incredible wealth of beautiful things she's created, he is inwardly furious that he doesn't own them. But what he does is he makes her a marriage proposal. And he tells her that if she'll marry him, he's a very rich man, and that she can come and live in his castle and eat off golden plates and sleep on eiderdown bed and in the garden, or will be birds of paradise singing to her all the time. Basically, she can have whatever she wants. And she'll have this beautiful, handsome man that she sees in front of her. But Mariushka feels that that wouldn't be right, because she feels that her gift of creativity was meant to be shared, not to be owned by one person. And so she says no. When she refuses him, he gets really furious. And in an instant, he changes her into a firebird with the feathers of beautiful, shining, transcendent colors like the rainbow. And he changes himself into a great big black falcon. And he snaps her up, this beautiful firebird, into these big falcon, dark black falcon claws. And in that instant, she realizes what's happened and decides to make a sacrifice of her life. And as the legend goes, her feathers drop to the earth and fall upon the ground. And they're still there today for all those who can recognize them and see the beautiful, transcendent, luminous colors of creativity shining on the ground they're there to create from. So that's the story of the firebird who escaped the demon lover and made the sacrifice symbolically of her life, which I take to be the ego attitude, for creativity and for sharing that creativity on the earth, which I think is important, with others. So that's all for the moment. Shall we take a break and then we'll come back? Okay, I'm going to get started. Okay, well, I thought what I would do is just give a very brief description of the major archetypal figures that they come in the first two parts of the book. The way the book is structured finally is it had a lot of different ways of structuring itself when I was writing it. For a while, I had something called the burning and the drowning and different things. But anyway, the way it finally structured itself was into three parts called the flight, the fall, and the creation. And the flight, I felt, is the phase, both in creativity and in addiction, where you're feeling a high and a euphoria and where you're excited by the creative vision of whatever it is. And that has to be there in creativity. You have to have a flight phase, I think, in order to create. And addiction usually gives you a euphoria. It certainly did for me. But then, at a certain point, that euphoria, it takes more and more to achieve that euphoria. And there's what I call the fall stage, like Icarus's fall, where It's as though something happens in the psyche, and everything gets very hardened and dark and black, and it's sort of like the fall of man in that sense. And I think there's also a fall stage in creativity where you then have to go down into the depths and deal with the dark chaos part and do the battleground work. And then there's the last part of the book is called The Creation, and that's the part of the book where I parallel the 12 steps with the creative process. In the first two parts of the book, the images that came out were personal, like characters in a drama, and almost city characters. You'll see when I go over them. And then in the last part of the book, where the 12 steps and the creative process are paralleled, the images that came out for me weren't so personal, and they more were connected with nature. So it's in that part of the book, and I'm not going to go into those chapters now because I want you to have a chance to ask questions, but in that part of the book I talk about the dark night of the soul and the abyss, which is an image that the mystics use that you fall into, and then the battleground, and then I have a chapter there on the life of Dostoevsky called The Soul on Fire, which was, which was the original title of this book, but then I realized there was a book that Elie Wiesel had written called Souls on Fire, and then I had a dream, and in this dream this title came out, Witness to the Fire. Anyway, and then I have a chapter called The Healing Fields, which has to do with the dwelling and the meditational aspect, and then I have a chapter which is on forgiveness also. And then I have a chapter called The Gift, which is on the giving process. That's the last part of the book. But what I'm going to do now is just go briefly over the inner characters. And in the last part of the book, there's a lot of poetry. There's poetry of, for example, Wendell Berry. He has a book out called The Sabbath, and he's a farmer. How many people are familiar with him? That's a fair number, actually, I think. He's a farmer. He's a Quaker, and he... is also a poet, and he does also a lot of writing about ecology, and some lovely essays and so forth. And anyway, on Sundays he set that aside as his day of rest from the farming, and which is like the 11th step, the regeneration phase of creativity. And that's when he wrote these poems that he put in this book called Sabbath, and they're really very beautiful poems. I could get sidetracked on the poems, but you can find them in the book or his book. And then there are poems by Theodore Rethke, who was... Actually, he's from here, right? Yeah, he taught here. At the University of Washington, who, you know, suffered from a manic depressive syndrome. He also drank, and he was a mystic. And I think an incredible poet. I mean, just a wonderful poet and has a stunning poem called In a Dark Time, and a wonderful, wonderful poem called The Abyss, which I looked at in detail in the book. So that's the sort of thing that's in the last part of the book. In the first part of the book, what I tried to do was describe these inner characters in ourselves, at least they're in me. And you can decide whether they're in you or not, I guess. And in the culture, too. So the first I mentioned already is the hostage, and who's the figure who realizes he's hostage, or she is hostage to his addiction. And also, there's a sense of being hostage to creativity. And so I started out that, actually, I can't resist reading this. I started out that section with a little poem from Boris Pasternak, who, as you know, was a poet, a novelist in Russia, and was literally a hostage in Russia in terms of the political system, at a time, and was and talks about being a hostage to the creative process too. And anyway, in this little poem, he says, keep awake, artist. Do not give in to sleep. You are eternity's hostage and prisoner of time. And the Russian film director Tarkovsky, Andrei Tarkovsky. How many are familiar with his films? He's really fantastic. He did a film called The Sacrifice, which you might remember, and he did Solaris. That might be a little bit more popular. Anyway, he takes that poem of Pasternak in his own book, which I think is called Sculpting in Time. It's his philosophy of creativity in film, and talks about how the creative person is really a servant who has to the creator, the creative force, who's chosen to accept this call to live in that creative tension, and to try to bear witness to the creative rather than to the destructive. That's a very beautiful book. Anyway, so the first chapter on the hostage is essentially what I presented tonight in its central ideas. And then the next chapter, and all these chapters are figures, is called, inner figures, is called The Moneylender. So The Moneylender, I felt, was the figure who gives initial energy, the initial energy or a high, usually promises something for nothing, kind of a quick fix. And the person who takes it, usually, who wants to refuse an offer like that? It sounds pretty good. But they end up paying exorbitant interest in the form of guilt and energy, and often with their entire life. So that's the notion of the moneylender. And you see this played out in Faust, between Mephistopheles and Faust. It's in a lot of different films and in a lot of different pieces of literature. Can you relate to that? There's an interesting thing about the moneylender. Since the workshop I'm not doing, I mean, I am doing, excuse me, maybe I'm, that was a slip. But I'm not doing a workshop on the addiction stuff per se tomorrow, though it'll probably enter in some way. It might be worth it to mention that there's, you know, in terms of that etymological meaning of the debtor in service to the creditor, the meaning in German for guilt also means debt, schuldig, and it means being responsible. And Heidegger does an analysis of that in Being in Time, and he points out that he feels, you know, that we're creatures, finite creatures, who have within our being an essential guilt, guilt being that we're not perfect, but that we often want to be totally perfect. We go to the one extreme or the other, want to be totally perfect or want to be totally guilty. So that's kind of like inflation and deflation, too, rather than bearing the tension of being finite and yet striving for the infinite. And so he points out that what we need to do is to accept this debt, this kind of essential debt that we have in our being. And as I was writing the book, I was talking to a lot of people who are in, you know, AA and NA and Al-Anon and various 12-step programs. Anyway, I talked to this one guy who is the person in the gambler chapter. And he's a real creative man. He was an artist and an alcoholic and a drug addict and so forth. And anyway, then he went into recovery, and I asked him what he thought the moneylender would be in the positive sense, and, you know, how he understood this idea. And he said, oh, well, he said in the positive sense, he said, that's real easy. He said, the creator gives us our life. And we're always responsible to the creator to give back to the creative process. You know, Hildegard of Bingen, the mystic, German mystic of the, I guess it was the 12th century, maybe it was the 11th century, I think it was the 12th century, though, talks about co-creation. You know, she has the idea of co-creating, creating with the creator. And so I thought, well, that's the way to understand the creative side of the moneylender and the debt, and to realize that the debt is a gift, which links it up with the last chapter and the 12th step of giving and the embodiment of the creative process. Can you connect that? See how that connects? so that you turn things a little bit here, and they can go from the addictive, destructive direction into the creative direction very easily. As soon as you see life as a gift and your own life as a gift both to yourself and to others, then it takes away, it bears the tension of the dark, not denying it, but can take that experience into and turn it into a creative one. So that's a quick fix on the moneylender. In that chapter are two stories of two people, two recovering people, and also an analysis of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh, where he talks about the pipe dream, the illusion of the pipe dream. So then the next figure is the gambler. The gambler is the one who wants to go beyond limits and it's not really the money. I turned to Dostoevsky for this because he was a gambler and he wrote a novel called The Gambler. And he wrote it. Dostoevsky is a very interesting figure because he always had a problem with money and he was always in debt. And the way he wrote his books was to get advances. But he had always piled up these incredible debts. And at one point, there was this one publisher who was very unscrupulous and unbeknownst to Dostoevsky, but bought up all of Dostoevsky's promissory notes, which amounted to a lot of money. And because he knew Dostoevsky was desperate, he gave him an offer on the condition that Dostoevsky would produce a novel by a certain date. Otherwise, all the money Dostoevsky would get from all of his works for 10 years would go to this man for the next 10 years. And so, Dostoevsky, you know, was he wrote an incredible amount and all the time, and he was in the middle of Crime and Punishment when all of a sudden he realized it was only 1 month to this date, and he certainly wasn't going to be finishing Crime and Punishment. And anyway, he'd already taken an advance from another publisher for that, so he had to write a novel real quick. And what he chose to do was The Gambler. He knew gambling very well because he was still in the midst of his gambling addiction while he wrote this. Anyway, Dostoevsky feels that the gambler is the one who always wants to go beyond all limits and risks and lives off excitement, okay? And likes to challenge fate. A little quote from Dostoevsky. This is what he feels happens to the gambler. He says, "I believe I had something like 4,000 gulden in my hands within 5 minutes." He's standing before the roulette wheel, the character in The Gambler. "That's when I should have quit. But a funny feeling came over me, some sort of desire to challenge fate, an uncontrollable urge to stick my tongue out it to give it a flip on the nose." So that's the attitude of the gambler. Now, I asked this man, who was the recovering person in the gambling chapter, his major thing wasn't gambling, though he also did gamble, and he had a lot of gambling dreams. And I asked him what he thought the positive part of gambling, when I interviewed him, it came out, really. And he said that he felt that the biggest gamble was the gamble of recovery, because it was an incredible gamble to risk living in the light and to living a creative life. And for anybody who's come from a dysfunctional family of any kind, they've grown up in the dark, and they know, I mean, it's kind of maybe a horrible experience, but it's what you know about. And so for that person, from the Jungian point of view, a lot of what's in the shadow is really the light, because they haven't experienced much of that light. And so he said, you really need the gambler for recovery, to take the risk of living in the light and also the risk of creativity. So that's the gambler. Is that enough? The romantic is next. And the romantic is the one who wants to long, or she longs to merge in infinite union with the loved one, but all the time and forever, and never gets enough of this, and starts out dreaming for this and lives in that longing. And when Wagner, wrote the opera to the legend Tristan and Isolde, wrote the prelude to that, he wanted to express that longing, and he said that he got so involved, and he was at that moment himself in love with a Swiss woman who was married and who was somebody who he couldn't really have, and who in some ways I suppose was a ghostly lover figure for him, an unattainable love to a certain degree. When he was writing the music to that, he said that he got so much into that feeling of longing in the music that he couldn't stop it. And so it goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And that's what happens with the romantic. They just want this merger to continue forever. But it can't, because we're finite. So you find in German Romanticism, and there's a lot about the romantic in the literature of German Romanticism, you find in those novels that often there's a start, the figure is a dreamer, and like in the Eichendorff novels and so forth, Flies and Novalis too, and Fantasies and so forth. But then when the realization comes that they can't have the kind of love they want in this life, then there's a preference to die rather than to live, because perhaps in death one could have that union that's sought forever. And that's where you get the German romantic notion of the Liebestod, which means love in death. And so in Tristan and Isolde, the lovers cannot live together in the day practical world, because Isolde is married off to Tristan's uncle, Mark, and they can only be together at night. And the night becomes the mysterious world, and the day becomes the practical world, and they would rather live in the night. And finally, they reject the day. So when the romantic gets into addiction, it starts to get very dark and goes down and goes towards death, and sometimes it goes towards suicide. And I think that quite often in relationships, one finds, too, a certain kind of split where one person lives out the romantic and the other person lives out the practical. And does this sound familiar at all? And secretly, and the romantic needs the practical, and secretly the practical person has the romanticism projected on the romantic. And almost, I worked with a couple who had this kind of situation, and almost feels like a killer, towards that other partner, because they think that romantic one is getting all the goodies. The romantic never gets enough anyway. So there's this split that exists, and I think that within every one of us we carry this tension of the longing for the infinite, the need to be practical, and that's one of the many of the creative tensions we have to live in. And I think it's, personally, I find it to be one of the hardest, because I'm a romantic and I've really had to work. That was a very difficult one to work through. On the creative side, the romantic, in longing for this eternal merger and union, is really thirsting intensely for the divine. And it's that longing that carries the energy for so many creative, wonderful creative works, I think. So I think the romantic is a really important energy, and not to be, as all of these are, they have their tough side and then they have their really needed side. Okay, for the romantic? In just about every chapter, there's the story of a person who is an addict of some kind or another who very much fits this energy, though they might have, they have this, a lot of the others too, they particularly embody, this energy. And then there's something from literature that also embodies it. So you get to look at it on the personal level and then also on the universal level. And then I tried to weave in philosophical and psychological insights in all that. So then the next figure that comes up I think, is the underground man. Now, I mentioned the underground man already, and that came from Dostoevsky, Notes from Underground. That's the romantic become cynical and disillusioned, and has decided to go underground, live there, broods about it, lives in resentment, and basically keeps their creativity to themselves. And so they've kind of withdrawn from the world and are withholding because they're really disappointed and angry that their dreams, which were wonderful, haven't been able to be fulfilled for whatever reason. So there's a kind of a bitterness and a festering that happens with the underground man. Yet the underground man is a very deep person, and it's underground man or underground woman, right? Because in that darkness, what they're really experiencing is the dark night of the soul. But they're kept there because they can't take the next step, which is to reach out or to make that surrender, which those first three of the 12 steps involve, and the creative process involves too. And I think that the underground man energy is a real important deep energy that is in creativity, but that also comes up in people as a creative block, as it did in me. I feel this is much after the time, retrospectively, when and in that period between writing The Wounded Woman and the Wedding Book, that I was kind of thinking, I wasn't conscious of this at the time, but now looking back on it, I see I was thinking, okay, if I can't have my drink, I'm not going to write or create or give. And I think I'll just read the first paragraph of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, because it's so dramatic. To give you a feeling, it starts out this way. He says, "I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I am an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased." However, and he's not an alcoholic, by the way. "However, I know nothing at all about my disease and do not know for certain what ails me. I don't consult a doctor for it and never have, though I have a respect for medicine and doctors. No, I refuse to consult a doctor from spite. That you probably will not understand. Well, I understand it, though. Of course, I can't explain who it is precisely that I am mortifying in this case by my spite. I am perfectly well aware that I cannot pay out the doctors by not consulting them. I know better than anyone that by all this I am only injuring myself and no one else. But still, if I don't consult a doctor, it is from spite. My liver is bad. Well, let it get worse." That's the underground man. So if you get a little bit of that feeling, you'll know who that character is. Okay. I think, and this is a thought I had after I wrote the book, but I think that the underground man connects with the wild man. You know, Robert Bly's doing a lot of stuff about the wild man, because the underground man is in touch with the irrational. And there's this marvelous part of the underground man, or Notes from Underground, where he talks about how the normally adapted man believes that reason rules things. But if we really look at it, we know that how much we really live from the irrational and how strong that is. And that's, in fact, the very basis of our freedom. So I think the underground man is very connected with the wild man and could be transformed to that. I think that would be a positive transformation for the underground man. And that he has this incredible depth. He lives in the depths. He knows the depths. And that is essential to creativity. Psalm 1. And then there's the outlaw. Now, the outlaw is in some ways an outgrowth of the Underground Man. I see them as connected, and but has moved to the point where he's at odds with the law in rebellion. The Underground Man is also at odds, a kind of a dropout, so to speak, but he hasn't yet moved to the stage of acting out against society. He's holding the bitterness in, and you know, maybe he'll commit suicide or something like that. Which is then, I suppose, he gets into the outlaw that way. But the outlaw does a lot of acting out, and one woman, this came up particularly in the story of one woman who was a heroin addict, who looked at all these other characters that I had drawn out. I didn't actually have the outlaw in here in the beginning because I'd already written something about the misfit. And she said, well, really, it was the outlaw that I was really living by, because I wanted an ecological society. I wanted to save the whales, and that wasn't happening in society, and I got sick of society, and then I found drugs, which went on to heroin for her, and she was a rock music singer, and she said, and I really got off on rebelling. And so the outlaw is a figure who finally takes all this and acts out against the law. Another man wrote me a letter who'd everybody has written this book in one way or another, but anyway, who'd read the book and said that he identified particularly with the outlaw because he had, in the 60s, he'd been in a lot of the movements of rebellion and so forth, you know, to try to improve society, which had its good point, except that what he realized was that he was hooked on the anger and rage that was festering there, and he couldn't move beyond that anger and rage. So that's the outlaw. Now, for the creative part, I was helped a lot by Camus, who wrote The Rebel. And in The Rebel, Camus talks about how we all have within us and the need, and what makes us human is that we need to be our unique individual selves with integrity. And we have to rebel against whatever, status quo structures would keep us from that. In other words, which would repress the creative daimon, okay, the anti-daimonic stuff that would repress that. But he says it's very easy for the rebellion to get festered with resentment, in which case, and he talks a lot about Shaler in there, who did an analysis of resentment, in which case the rebel then moves on to be the murderer. But if the rebel can take that rebellion, that all that energy of rebellion, and use it for human transformation, then what he finds is an incredible solidarity with humankind. And I feel that's what operates often in the 12-step meetings. And for lots of people, one of the big problems with 12-step meetings is that the notion of God, a lot of people have a problem with the notion of God. They can't accept that. And Camus, as you know, was an agnostic. So Camus' rebel doesn't believe in a transcendent force outside this world, but what he does believe in is the transcendence of which the human person somehow is capable of, and which is beyond just the ego. And I felt that it's that energy that is very creative in community, I guess you could say. Okay? For the outlaw? Then comes the trickster, who's probably a familiar figure to many of you, and has that energy to trick us either into creativity or into addiction. And as you know, the trickster is a shapeshifter, and you can't quite put your finger on the trickster, and the shaman is often connected with the trickster. Trickster often has an androgynous form and a phallus where he can or she can plant seeds in the ground, and the creative can come out of that. But you can be tricked into addiction or into a relapse very easily. So the trickster can operate that way. And Jack London really describes that in John Barleycorn. It's amazing, the power of his description of John Barleycorn as whiskey. of John Barleycorn as a trickster and how it increasingly develops and very subtly into denial in a very, very clever way. And London says you end up with the white logic of pessimism and cynicism, which kills off everything. So that's one way. But the trickster can also trick you into creativity and recovery. And I think that's actually what happens to many people who hit bottom, go into recovery, and all of a sudden they find they're on a spiritual path, and they're tricked into that spiritual path through their addiction. They never didn't know that's where they were heading, but somewhere inside themselves, that's what they were thirsting for, really, although they were doing whatever they were doing, drinking or whatever. And then they get tricked into their spirituality and their creativity. And one woman came up after a lecture and told me that she had done an intervention on her husband, who was an alcoholic, and she was really going to change things there and change him. But part of the intervention required that she go into group meetings and into therapy and into Al-Anon. And so she was then tricked into the recognition that she herself was a co-addict and got into recovery that way. So that's the trickster. Everybody have a sense of the trickster? Very tricky. It was operating all the time when I was writing this book because the different figures were interfering. I mean, I'd start on one chapter and then, like, I'd be writing, trying to write the romantic chapter, and then a figure called the mad woman would come up and grab my energy, and then I'd turn to her, and then the gambler would come up and grab my energy, and that was the way this book was. It was a very interesting process, to say the least. Anyway, then the mad woman, that I see as the devouring hunger for love that often brings people into chaos. And for this chapter, I use the writings of Jean Rhys, who was a romance addict and who was always hungering for love and never getting enough love. And at first was really putting all the blame on the man and on the outer figure. But as she wrote her... How many people are familiar with Jean Rhys? It's R-H-Y-S. But as she was writing her novels, and she wrote like six or seven, I can't remember, each novel was about the same thing, but she just would take it a step further on the inner level. She began to realize that what was really happening was that that in that great hunger for the perfect romance, she was feeling rejected, that she didn't get it, and then she would become paranoid. And you can see that really amazingly portrayed in the movie Camille Claudel, which, has that been here? I think it's a remarkable portrayal of that. Until finally, she destroys all of her work and in reality gets committed to an insane asylum for 20 years. So that's the mad woman. Now, the mad woman has an incredible amount of creativity. From being down there in the depths with all that chaos, but needs to have some form to process that through, and somehow has to get beyond, has to acknowledge the anger and the rage and all that, but somehow get beyond it to the point where she or he can give back from the chaos something new. There's more to say about the mad woman, and I will probably dwell on that particular figure at greater length tomorrow. So there's an incredible amount of creativity in the mad woman, but it also can be very destructive. And this is where the fall chapter starts, where things get to be very dark and very hard. And they're already dark, but they really get dark here. And then the next chapter is called The Judge. And I feel that in each of us, and also culturally, the mad woman and the judge are at war. The judge I see the mad woman as connected with the matriarchy out of balance, the judge with the patriarchy out of balance. The judge as the figure who wants to always be on top, not being judged themselves, but judging others, being above judgment, but judging others, being superior and highest and perfect. And I think these two are in mortal battle with each other right now, and really need to be transformed for there to be any kind of a wedding between men and women, the inner masculine and feminine, and the earth. And I think the movie The War of the Roses really, did you see that? Shows that battle in a very interesting way between the madwoman and the judge. It's a story of a marriage, and which ends it into a war between these two figures, one of whom is the madwoman, one of whom is the judge. For the judge, I use.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.